It's been said, and I've said it already this morning, that there's something of a conspiracy of silence which has been observed by New Zealand historians when it comes to the subject of cannibalism. How widespread was this in reality in this country? What was the motive? And what were the consequences? And why has there been internationally a wave of revisionism about cannibalism, claims that it either didn't exist, a figment of a rather lurid European imagination, or that it was far less common than has been assumed? Well, Paul Moon set out to assemble the evidence, and he's laid them out in a new book, This Horrible Practice, it's called, and he came in to tell us about it. What was your overall objective in writing this book?
Well, it initially started because cannibalism has been the one subject in New Zealand history that's been effectively fenced off. It's almost as though there's an unspoken consensus among historians and others that that topic is out of bounds. So I was keen to investigate it, and I was also concerned about the growing importance of the revisionist movement when it comes to looking at issues related to traditional cannibalism.
Well, let's deal with the first one first. I mean, why has it been a taboo? There has been very little written, very little analysis of it. Is it really just squeamishness? Is it a sense of shame that this could have happened in our lovely country?
I don't think so. I think that there's any number of books about wars and so forth that have happened, so I don't think it'll be squeamishness. I know one fairly prominent academic, and I won't name him, chatted to me early on in the stages when I was writing the book, and he said, look, this is going to ruin your career.
Really?
And I thought that was an odd comment. I didn't think it was much of a career worth having if you can't address these things. I think there's a lot of political sensitivity around the topic, and that's one of the reasons why people have chosen not to address it. If you look at Keith Sinclair's History of New Zealand, I think he devoted all of one sentence to cannibalism.
Yes.
Michael King, of course, didn't even mention it in his History of New Zealand, so it's slowly been pruned out of our sense of the past.
Was that essentially because people simply didn't know any more than that it existed?
Oh, no, look, there's no excuse. There's any number of sources, and I located a huge number in the course of my research, and I also left out a vast number because there was so much evidence of it. You can't read through the primary material of the first half of the 19th century relating to New Zealand without coming across cannibalism in some form. It's everywhere.
The conventional view, as I understand it, is that, yes, this existed, and yes, it was terrible, but let's move on. Why go on and on about it? Because it just existed and that's that. You've gone into some of the reasons why you think it existed, and they are fascinating, but they're not entirely conclusive. The reasons why Maori indulged in this, I mean, there are, whether it was revenge, whether it was the absorption of mana of somebody, whether it was retribution of some kind, and yet there doesn't ever seem to be any conclusive consensus anywhere that is what it was. What's your response to that?
Well, that's correct, and that's deliberate as well. There's a lot of pressure on people. I know when people write their theses, for example, they're encouraged to come up with a conclusion, and they have to back it up with evidence. Life isn't always like that. You don't get clear-cut answers, and rather than just fabricating a conclusion to make the book seem rounded off at the end, I thought it's best just to explore the possibilities and really leave it at that, because that's all the evidence allows. And I think it's a bit dangerous if you make too much of a speculative leap. But one of the things that the book dispels is this myth that Maori did consume people to absorb their mana. It was interesting that in fact, just about every other book that happens to mention Maori cannibalism, usually in passing, uses that as the excuse that, well, yes, they did eat other people, but it was part of some great spiritual symbolic process in which they consumed their mana. To me, that didn't add up at all. And the more I looked into it, and the more I talked with some Maori who are very well versed in the culture, the more I realised it's just a complete fabrication. I started off observing that I think as late as the 1850s or 1860s that suggestion was first made. When cannibalism was being practiced in the country and Europeans are writing about it, no Maori ever mentioned that as a reason. It came fairly late in the piece.
All right, what was the reason? What was the major reason?
I suppose if we're going to narrow it down a bit further, it's to do with rage to start off with, and the nature of community life in general prior to European involvement. These are communities that felt, for most of the time, besieged. They knew that they were under threat at some point in the future. They knew they were going to be involved in a battle. And they knew the threat was that they'd be not only killed, but perhaps mutilated, tortured, eaten as well. These are all things that happen to people. And so the best way to deal with that was to prepare yourselves and to be prepared to visit the same sort of activities on your enemies. So the community was had the sense that it was always about to stumble into a battle, always about to face some fairly horrible consequences.
Yeah.
So people were trained at a very young age, boys in particular, to kill. So there was any number of examples I've used of young children being taught about how to kill, being people as young as 9 or 10 being taken along to battles so they could get a taste of killing.
Yes.
And the rage was quite intense. And, of course, it's not just Maori society. I mean, there's even accounts of this in the Second World War with the Russian occupation of Berlin, that fairly horrible things happen in the immediate aftermath of a battle.
You put this down to institutionalised instability. At one point in the book you say, the turbulence of traditional Maori life, it's almost institutionalised instability. Such a far cry from the noble savage vision some Europeans imagine might apply in the region was the perfect ingredient to help ferment the type of trauma that would contribute to, but by no means be solely responsible for cannibalism taking place. Maori society, yes, I guess, was in many respects turbulent in that respect. But was there some kind of collective psychosis at work here?
This is quite possible, and I've explored some recent science which deals with the way trauma is transmitted through generations. And the victims of the Holocaust, some of their grandchildren have measurable levels of trauma that are above the average in the community. And there's a lot of research being done currently in areas of epigenetics and so on.
Yes.
And it's highly likely that if communities are repeatedly subject to extreme traumas and seeing people in your community being mutilated, killed and eaten is traumatic, if you're repeatedly subject to that, then the trauma can be transmitted. And there's a few interesting examples where Maori are talking to missionaries in the mid-19th century, and there's a sense of relief that the missionaries have come to their community and there's now a sustained period of peace. They feel that this trauma they've been living with and their parents and any number of generations backwards been living with has gone at last, and they don't have to expect constant warfare.
Yes. And yet, in almost the very next paragraph, you temper this with reference to other societies equally traumatised in their own ways, either dispensed with it or never developed it. So there is an element of doubt in all this, isn't there?
Well, one of the distinguishing features about Maori culture up until roughly, say, 1800 is that it was isolated from other cultures. It had gone through several centuries where, I don't really want to use the phrase, but they didn't know better or didn't have the possibility of knowing any different, because they only had their own experience, their own practice for terms of reference.
Yes.
So it's very difficult to say, well, we're going to do something different now, because there's no different model to look at to emulate.
Well, let's look further back beyond that. As I was struck by the reference, I didn't know this, that Tupaia, who had been picked up by Cook in Tahiti, as we all know, was appalled at what he saw here, which suggests, and I don't know whether there's any other evidence of this, that was a normal reaction for a Tahitian, or maybe just a normal reaction for a nobly born Tahitian. I don't know, but how far back can you trace the origins in Polynesia of this?
Well, it's very difficult. We can trace it back probably to the earliest Polynesian settlement in New Zealand, and we know that cannibalism was something that the early Maori brought with them from Polynesia.
We know that.
Okay. And the reason we know it is because, in a few cases, for archaeological reasons, but also because there's a lot of evidence in the legends in Whakapapa which talk about cannibalism being practiced very early on at the point of Polynesian settlement in New Zealand.
But supply reasons, if I put it crudely?
Very unlikely.
Very unlikely.
There was a large supply of birds and fish and so on. So and the food supply has never been a reason. Some people have speculated on that. They've said that that the communities were running out of food and they resorted to cannibalism. The fact is, if you read the accounts of Europeans coming here from the late 18th century, very clearly they're impressed with the physique of Maori. They say, look, they're stout, they're robust, muscular, and there's these sort of pale, emaciated Europeans looking on at them in wonder. So there was no shortage of food.
How much do we know about the consistency of the practice around the country, how widespread was it? Were there exceptions?
It's been alleged there were exceptions. The Chatham Islands people, one of the groups that some people have said in the past, well, they never practiced cannibalism. But I discovered in their own oral histories they in fact did. It's difficult to say absolutely again because the evidence doesn't allow that. But what evidence has survived indicates that in almost all parts of the country there are examples of cannibalism having taken place. And if we assume that an account of cannibalism might be one account reflecting perhaps many episodes in that area, the chances are that every part of the country it took place in. We know for infanticide, for example, that it was widespread from the very bottom of the South Island, almost to the tip of the North Island, that the killing of newborn children was reasonably common. And cannibalism similarly seems to have been spread throughout the country.
What were the first reports of it? Cook arrived 1769 and noted it, and as did Banks. And you talk about their responses in some detail. I guess because you can trust the judgments of either or both in their different ways to be relatively reliable sources. Yes. Huh?
Well, I didn't trust anyone.
All right.
What I did is to
more than most.
Yeah, well, I had to establish how trustworthy people were, and there's been a lot of attacks on the nature of cannibalism. So it's not good enough just saying, well, someone's written this, it must be true. So I went through a process of looking at how reliable, if you like, the witnesses were. And I dwelt fairly strongly on Cook's voyages and the people who accompanied him, simply because they're the first example and because Cook was a bit of a doubter himself. He wasn't inclined to prejudge groups, and he didn't want to come to the conclusion that these people were cannibals simply because they looked ferocious. He needed evidence, and it's very interesting. Some opponents have argued that, well, Europeans saw cannibals everywhere. They almost intuitively were predisposed to see non-Europeans as being cannibals. Cook wasn't like that. He was almost the opposite.
And Banks was prepared to accept that, in spite of everything, Maori were lovable people, in spite of this in particular, and seems to have been very temperate in his reaction to cannibalism, even though you've quite several points in his diaries in which he says he's appalled by it. Mm. I mean, how dramatic would it have been for somebody seeing the evidence of this, fresh evidence of this for the first time?
I suspect slightly less dramatic than it would be for modern societies, because we're not accompanied by death all the time.
Yeah.
When we travel overseas, we don't throw a few people out the plane at each airport stop, whereas in the 18th, 19th centuries, typically people were thrown off board when they died. They were buried at sea, and that was common. And people were used to seeing war, and certainly in periods of exploration, they'd seen conflicts and so on. So seeing people being killed and seeing dead people was not uncommon. The fact of those people being eaten would have been shocking, but some people have argued, look, the act of killing is far worse.
Yeah. The what's called the Margaret Mead syndrome, I suppose, has to be looked at here. The fact that some Maori clearly played up the act of their cannibalism, dramatised it, and maybe even exaggerated the fact that it existed. And that too is a dimension of I suppose, of filtering the history of this.
Yes, and that's something that I was also very cautious about. There are elements of almost play acting. There are elements of people wanting to get attention. There are cases where, very often, in fact, where there are exaggerations. Hongi is said to have brought 2,000 or 3,000 prisoners to Northland, and in one day cooked him and his troops cooked and ate them all. Well, you simply can't eat 2,000 or 3,000 people in one day. You'd have great difficulty getting the logistics right just to cook them.
Yeah.
So there was a lot of exaggeration, and that's part of, I suppose, establishing your military prowess, the fact that you can eat all these people and kill all these people. And there were cases of performance where Maori would eat human flesh, at least one case I came across, where they would do it just to shock Europeans. But that doesn't go any way, really, to say that the practice never took place. It's just that in some cases there were exaggerations.
There seems to have been a mixture of ritualized behavior around it, and sort of every day, let's just get on with it. We make the fire and throw them on.
Yep. The ritualized part of it was fairly slender. I think that after battles, people were eaten. They were cooked and eaten fairly hastily. But there are a number of episodes, again, as you say, fairly casual. There was one case where a girl had walked off from a village for a couple of days, probably 13 or 14 years old. She came back. An elderly woman in the community told her off, was very angry at the girl for walking off, then called a man to come over, and the man came over and she gave some instructions to the man. He then hit the girl on the head, cut her head open, and within half an hour they had chopped her up and were preparing to cook her. And this was something that was witnessed by some Europeans.
Yeah.
So that's a fairly casual example, not much ritual involved at all.
It more or less disappeared over a period of a few decades.
Mm. And that's the most, I think, the most staggering feature of the whole practice.
Was it just the missionaries, or was there something else at work here?
Certainly missionaries were very influential, but on the other hand, if you take a whole lot of cultural tenets, if you look at tattooing, the language, warfare, cannibalism, all of these tenets survived the strongest assaults by the missionaries and others on them. So tattooing persisted, so did the language, so did warfare. Cannibalism, on the other hand, there are cases within a month or so of Europeans arriving in a Maori settlement that the practice ceases. So here's a practice that goes back potentially thousands of years. It's been embedded in the culture and it just collapses in on itself in a period of months. And I suspect the reason is that when there was contact with another culture, those communities that practiced cannibalism began to see that it was counterproductive to them. And they saw an alternative now, a future without cannibalism, and yes, they very quickly abandoned it.
It seems to have come back again during the wars, the land wars. There's a reference to Titokawaru abstaining, I think in 1865, because it would somehow impair his mana tapu. It flared up again here and there, but in situations of extreme warfare. But then that was it. It died off and it was gone.
Yes, there's a loose pattern there between warfare and what I've termed rage cannibalism, which is cannibalism that takes place after a very heated period of conflict. And it's not really dissimilar from the sort of rage episodes that take place in conflicts all over the world. They always have.
Yeah.
And so when you get the wars in the 1860s, where there are some fairly intense periods of fighting, this trait resurfaces, but it quickly subsides. And that's, I think, what happened then.
What's finally going to happen to the revisionist argument here, Obayasekere's argument that somehow all this has been concocted? I mean, you take it on.
Yes, well, I think it's necessary. I was shocked that the vast majority of literature internationally on traditional cannibalism now, in one form or another, denies that it ever took place. It's something that's been invented by the evil Europeans to stigmatise non-European communities.
That's drawing a very long bow.
Yes, and as I said, look, if it was one or two books that had made that argument, you could perhaps consign them to the sort of conspiracy theory bin or something. But this is, as I say, the majority thinking in the academic world. There's one woman who accepts some cannibalism did take place. She's an anthropologist in the United States. But in her book, she said that the West is still guilty for stigmatizing the practice. She said that it's a perfectly legitimate cultural practice, and the West has been responsible for stigmatizing cannibalism. And I thought that was an odd argument. I sent an email to her asking if she was in that particular cultural group, would she eat human flesh?
Hmm.
She never replied. But it's the point that academics can make fairly well-constructed arguments and fairly convincingly sounding arguments, but they don't necessarily correspond with reality.
Yes, and that was author Paul Moon. His book, This Horrid Practice, is published by Penguin. I hope they didn't put you off your brunch.